Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine. An opportunity to stand together against the forces that thrive off our division and to see this world as a land for all who inhabit it. We reject the polarities while accepting the differences between us. Yes, we're talking about the Middle East and we are hopeful about our future. Because I'm Douglas Rushkoff and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, artist, designer, technologist, writer, and Israeli peace activist Mushan Zer Aviv.
Our grief is not your weapon. And I think it's a very strong message, because I think our grief has been weaponized.
Mushan is going to show us why binary partisanship in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is hurting both sides and what to do about it. It's time to intervene on behalf of people and all living things. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and please hear this. We're all on Team Human. Mushan Zer Aviv was a student of mine maybe 20 years ago, and now I'm a student of his. While I was frozen in place after the October 7th Hamas attacks and subsequent Israeli massacres, Mushan, a peace activist in the region who was directly impacted by all this, had no such luxury. As a proponent for a shared equal society for everyone in the region, he has enemies and detractors from all sides. But by the same logic, he also has allies everywhere, including me. Here's our conversation, which took place the morning after the Israeli-Arab peace group Standing Together was banned and boycotted by an American anti-war group 6,000 miles away for suggesting that Jews be allowed to live alongside Arabs in the Middle East after the conflict is over. What was most interesting about Mushan's perspective is that he sees empathy as a problem. He wrote a fascinating piece called Your Empathy is Killing Us, in which he explains that empathy does not scale. Rather, it could be weaponized to promote the hostility toward one side or the other. As you'll hear, Mushan thinks there's a better way. Welcome to Team Human. It's so good to see you. I've known you for it must be a long time now. Like you were young. We were all young.
We were young.
ITP. You were in the media theory and interactive narrative lab and those things. And from what I remember, you did, even then, you did a project about, well, it was about the kind of the Palestinian experience, wasn't it? It was this immersive experience where you moved around and you were moving around as if you were there. I'm trying to remember it. What was this? What was it?
So it actually started in 2006. The project was called You Are Not Here. And we called it a dislocative tourism agency. it's a project I worked on with Katie London, Ben Pfeiffer, and Thomas Duke, if you remember.
Mm-hmm. All of them, for sure. The best, best of the best. And you add in Heather Dewey Hagborg, and you've got the all-star team of ITP. Yeah.
And we called it, and it started actually not about Gaza. It started as a tour of Baghdad through the streets of New York. And only a year later, we did another iteration that was a tour of Gaza through the streets of Tel Aviv. And in both these projects, at the heart of the project was a two-sided map. One is a tourist map of Gaza, and the other one was a street map of Tel Aviv. And we printed the street map of Tel Aviv on the back of the tourist map of Gaza, and then when you held the map to the light, you could see the streets of Tel Aviv through the streets of Gaza in 1-to-1 ratio, and you could navigate the tourist map of Gaza by walking the streets of Tel Aviv. So let's say you wanted to visit the Anon Soldier statue in the heart of Gaza City. You would find the corresponding spot in Tel Aviv, and you would actually walk there. And this one specifically happens to be not very far from where I live right now. But in the street, you would find a sticker with a telephone number and an extension. You would call the telephone number, you enter the extension, and you get an audio tour of that corresponding location in Gaza. And with the Gaza project, we actually worked with Leila El Fadad, which is a Palestinian blogger and journalist from Gaza. Leila chose all of the locations, wrote them, recorded them, and you have to remember that this is 2007, even before the iPhone. So it was all like printed maps and stickers.
Right, we didn't have geolocation, because it's like if you did it today, you would just walk to that location. The phone would know what street you're on in Gaza, corresponding to where you are in Tel Aviv. It would be all automatic. But now, right, you go and you find a sticker and you dial in an individual phone number. But still, it was a mapping of one real space as a virtual extension of another real space.
Yeah, and with Leila, I say, you know, in the beginning, I was really concerned that Leila wouldn't want to work with me as an Israeli. But we really became good friends, and until today. And when we worked on the actual texts, we tried to get to something that is beyond guilt. So the audience was the residents of Tel Aviv, and the title there, it was trying to engage the detachment from Gaza. So 2005 was the Israeli disengagement from the Gaza Strip, and the project was launched 2 years after. And what we're arguing is that the disengagement from the Gaza Strip was first and foremost an emotional disengagement. You could really learn more about the life of people in Gaza back in 2007 that is not really detached from Israel. It's not like all extreme stories of conflict, even though we had some of those. But even in an audio clip where Leila is taking us to the best ice cream place in Gaza, she describes the prices in shekel, the Israeli currency, and all of a sudden you're saying, "Oh, we've disengaged from the Gaza Strip. How come the currency is in shekel?" So apparently, like the reality of Israel's engagement, continued engagement in Gaza was kind of sipped in through everything. This was still before the blockade started. And you know, the project, it's a part of a wider interest that I have in mapping and many mapping projects that I've done since, including, audio tours and GPS related projects. But back then in 2006, 2007, we called the project You Are Not Here. And it was inspired by how on subway maps in New York, you had the little mark on the subway map that says "You are here," that kind of connects the physical presence and the representation on the map, and kind of talking about spatial and emotional disengagement, right? And now, you know, obviously, I've reflected on that project today, and back now in 2023, 2024, are we not there?
Right. No, we're not. Well, the interesting thing is, so in 2005, there was the sort of the separation. Okay, you have your place, we'll have our place. We're going to leave you alone. We're going to withdraw. And it had a little bit, almost an extreme version of the quality of from the 20s forward, really, when they started building housing projects for poor Black people in America. It's like, okay, we're going to find this area outside the city that we don't have to go to unless we're commuting. We're going to put you all there. Here's your apartment. Take care of yourself. Goodbye. You know, and it's sort of, on the one hand, it was a well-meaning lefty liberal. Oh, we're going to give everyone apartments. But on the other hand, it was a way of utterly disconnecting. Like, they're over there. They're going to take care of themselves. I mean, and your project in some ways, by saying you are not here, it has a meaning then, which is this is still going on. This is still right there. And you can try to identify with some of these things, but you are not there. You are here. You're in a totally different friggin' reality, but you are still essentially co-located with your brothers and sisters who you are now ignoring, right? Who are now, you know, festering in this economic, political wasteland, you know, this basically a quasi-embargoed territory and our government has no real intention of letting it become a nation. It is actually actively working to have your territory compete with the politics in the Palestinian Authority's territory. But la, 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 we're going to have ice cream in Tel Aviv and ignore it utterly, right? And that's, you know, cut to 20 years later, which is today, and we see, I mean, how unsustainable that relationship to place is, but how similarly still, I mean, for as an American, the reason the project has so much meaning for me is the way people have so many opinions and judgments on all sides in America about what is going on there, but they are not there. They are not there, and we impose our opinion of what we think should be happening there as if we know more than the peace activists on the ground in the region who are begging us not to use the frameworks that we're using to describe what's happening.
I think it's back to the question of stakes in the game, I guess. But it's not only about spatial presence. I still think it is about emotional presence and emotional attachment. And actually, Leila, who lives in the U.S. now, and she wasn't there in Gaza. She obviously is very very much there, and she actually lost a lot of family members and friends, and is a very active and ferocious Palestinian activist. And she reached out a couple of weeks ago, and she said, should we revive the project? Should we revive You Are Not Here? And I was like, I don't know. Like the thing is, the residents of Gaza are not there now. Like, they have been evacuated from their own homes. And in a way, Gaza itself is not there. And we, as Israelis, or we as the Israeli army, are definitely there now. And I would even say a few of the we as
we are
as,
there, as, right?
a few of the we as Israeli hostages are still there, I hope. But you know what? Even today, I think most of the we as in the Israeli public are not there. Like the emotional disengagement continues and is even worse.
Right. And the solution set that so many people are looking for is a solution set of what has to happen for me not to have to think about this anymore, you know? And usually that involves the elimination of people, not the the engagement and nourishment of people. But I'm wondering, did that project lead either directly or indirectly to your work with A Land for All, which is for people who don't know it, it's a shared movement of Israelis and Palestinians, working together toward peace, primarily toward peace in the region by, protesting against the governments on both sides that are preventing peaceful solutions from being reached.
Well, I think at least to some degree it has, because for me, I was engaged with Gaza. I'm familiar with the geography of Gaza, not by walking the streets of Gaza, but by walking the streets of Tel Aviv. And when I walk in my city, in the way that I love my city, and I can relate to how meaningful these streets were for Leila, and for me that created an attachment that was very powerful, an attachment that I've tried to scale since then through different projects as well. But when it comes to A Land for All, like the model that we are trying to promote, that is not based on detachment, not based on separation, but instead based on partnership, is very much a central part of what You Are Not Here was about.
Right. And are you like one of the founders of A Land for All? Is there such a thing? No.
Not at all. Like A Land for All started 12 years ago, and I'm not one of the founders. It took me some years to actually open up to the hope that is in the heart of this idea, because A Land for All promotes a new model for the two-state solution. So it's not about two states that are based on separation of, like, how do we redraw the borders so we don't see each other anymore. But the idea is still we call it two states, one homeland. And the idea is that there are two different states with different citizenships and so on, but with open borders and with shared institutions. So it's based on it's a confederate model rather than a complete separation.
More like New York and New Jersey than U.S. and Canada or something.
In a way, more like Germany and France than you know, yeah.
In an EU together of some sort.
Yeah, so the EU is a confederacy in that sense.
Right, so it's not totally weird. I mean, because when I was reading about it, I was thinking, oh, so it's like, could like those of us on the same block belong to different nations. It wouldn't work like that, right? Like this house is Israel, that house is Palestine, this house is Israel.
No, it's nothing like that. It's still it still includes borders and right. And autonomy and administration of land and it's not based on how can we find a way of separating people
right.
and
right.
separating.
So you could do anything. You could cross. I could go to the pool on that side, or you can have a job on this side, and we're just whatever. But you pay your taxes to them, and this one pays your taxes to there, and there's not like a wall between the two, keeping your guys out of our side and our side out of your side.
Yeah, and obviously today it's very very hard to talk about anything like that after. The idea of freedom of movement is an open wound on both sides. But really the technological and military separation, and as we tried to argue 20 years ago, the emotional separation is something that is something that can never promise a future. That's something that would always lead to more hate and more animosity, and at the end of the day, to violence and the collapse of our ability to have a decent life in this region.
Yeah, but those of us who are not there, right? It's. I guess, and not that you have to have an answer, but I'm kind of asking for an answer here. It's like, what is the appropriate response? So, you know, I have friends and I felt this way too. You know, we see on October 7th on the news, you know, the young women being carried away from Israel and paraded in the streets and abused and killed and hostaged. Then we see a thug, sorry, like Netanyahu, you know, bombing the smithereens out of people and saying, I don't even want a nation. I don't even care. You know, basically saying stuff that without even really reading between the lines, he seems perfectly willing to let as many people die as have to in order to find, you know, a hostage that may or may not even be in the control of Hamas at this point, or talking about no nation and this. And My American friends on both sides of this conflict, which I hate to even use that kind of terminology, are angry and protesting and using inflamed language and inflamed stuff. And what's the appropriate alternative, if there is one, to being angry and shouting in the streets for justice for your side of this conflict?
One of the signs that I saw that really spoke to that it says, "Our grief is not your weapon," and I think it's a very strong message, because I think our grief has been weaponized. But how do you move forward from that point? How are we like unless the end game is indeed the annihilation of one side? At some point we will have to find a way to live together. We will have to find a way to build trust, and for that it starts by breaking that tit for tat, by breaking this quantified competition that the whole world has been weighing in on, rather than helping us.
I mean, you did a piece shortly, I mean, it was still in October. You wrote a piece with some of the, I hate to use a word like this, but unhelpful, I guess, responses that we can have to this this kind of tragedy. And I was hoping you could kind of go through those with us.
Yeah. So it was really hard to really put into words everything that was going on. I think everybody was in a sense of in shock, and it was so extreme ever since that it was really, really hard to write. But I've been working on that piece for a couple of weeks, actually, really trying to put things together. And the piece is called "Your Empathy Is Killing Us." And by your empathy, I meant it to be ambiguous. The point is that people have been empathizing a lot, both with what has been happening on both sides of the fence, of that broken fence. First on October 7th with the Hamas attack that has been horrific, and I don't think anyone recovered from that in Israel, and the sense of victimhood, which is real, has been blinding us completely. But the same in the world, like the demand that Israel put out to the world is like, look, we are victims. This is the worst day for Jewish people since the Holocaust. You have to stand with Israel. And it's really hard to ignore the levels of the levels of trauma and the levels of violence that happened there, but at the same time, immediately that has turned into the attack on Gaza. First as a way of, you know, dismantling rockets, but it definitely did not stop there. And we are close to 4 months later, and it keeps going on. And with the hostage situation going on, like the images coming out of Gaza has been the same. They've been or not the same, different and horrible in different ways, but generating this immediate sense of empathy, and that empathy has been turned into the problem with empathy is that empathy works as a spotlight, and that has been proven in research as well, that empathy is built on me being able to see myself through your experience, to really experience the world the way you experience them, you experience it. But and it's a very powerful emotion. The problem is that when it's it doesn't scale, right? In a way, it's really hard for us to empathize with many people. And in fact, research actually shows that empathy falls as soon as we extend from one person to two, right? Because empathy is about the other person, the other personal experience. And empathy has become a problem here, because as a spotlight, it shines light on the one but leaves the many in the dark. So if you're empathizing with Israelis, it's really hard for you to see Palestinians. And if you're empathizing with Palestinians, it's really hard for you to see see the pain on the Israeli side. And that is a way of prolonging the war. That is a way of denying pain. And that has been really dangerous, and one of the engines of what is happening over here.
So you're saying that empathy creates a sense of identification, and if you over-identify with one side or the other, you end up experiencing one, you know, true but incomplete narrative. So you know the injustices, you know, you could. The injustice, it always depends where you start. And ultimately, I mean, this was part of where I finally got to was, oh, I see there are two true yet incompatible narratives, right? they're incompatible. They don't work. The two histories both involve so
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Much injustice and oppression and rejection and exile and torment that and Nazism and racism and, you know, a genocide and all those things that you kind of can't do an accounting. You know, the way sort of modern social justice warriors kind of use Twitter and Instagram receipts as a way of kind of compiling, it's a very digital age bias, right? We can find the exact, we have the memory, we have the recording, let's go back to the tape and show exact, and we will account for this. Like, there's a app for this. There's a blockchain analysis of injustice will yield the truth. And it's like that, not only is that impossible to do in this case, but it's a booby prize. Who cares, right? Who cares? On a certain level, it's like, start right now. There's all of these human beings in pain, bleeding. There's babies dying. How do we stop this right now? You know, is where I come around to it.
I've been writing about empathy in the context of design for a long time, because this is where I'm coming from. And, you know, designers tap them, you know, themselves on the back for being very empathetic, right? That empathy is a superpower of design. This is a part of that disgusting design thinking language. And it's about analyzing the other, right? How do I understand what you're going through? And in the case of design, unfortunately, in many cases, it was how can I understand your emotions so I can take advantage of you?
Right. And it's not empathy. That is not actual empathy. That's calculation, right? That's analysis and calculation. It's an approximation of empathy through data.
It's actually called in science cognitive empathy, and it's something that psychopaths are really good at, right? They know how to manipulate you, right? I think what we're looking for is not empathy as much as we're looking for compassion. And compassion, to be compassionate, I don't necessarily need to feel what you feel, but I can acknowledge what you feel. And it also it's something that can scale. But for that, I need to, as you said, I need to break out of this quantified culture of trying to understand who's the victim and who's the perpetrator, of dividing the world to zeros and ones, breaking from that binary that doesn't allow me to get the compassion that would get either sides out of this mess.
I think when I try to separate between empathy and compassion, I think empathy is very much looking at the past, at what happened, and at that set of feeling that I identify with, and compassion is much more committed towards the future, or a future,
right?
And a future that cares not only about the pain that was, but is committed towards preventing the pain from the future. And if you are committed towards preventing pain and committed towards the future, you have to be compassionate and you have to see a bigger picture rather than that approach. There's no doubt that the amount of death and misery at this point in Gaza is uncomparable.
And I've kind of, in the article, I divided these problematic responses. The first is yes, no. There's the good and the bad. There's the evil and the saint and you know, this attempt that every element where you would acknowledge the pain of the other side would come in the expense of the side that you see as the one you need to stand with. And to be clear, I see that problem on both sides, on the so-called pro-Israeli side and the so-called pro-Palestinian side. And I'm saying so-called because I don't think this is what it means to be pro-Israeli, and I don't think this is what it means to be pro-Palestinian. But the second type of response is the yes, but. The yes, but does acknowledge that there's pain on both sides, but then it starts to calculate them. It creates this imagined axis of righteousness or imagined aligned axis of victimhood and trying to, you know, body count or count the pain or count the missiles or count the gunpowder or the money or whatever. And in a way, to some degree, you have to do that, but when the final outcome of that, it's usually the same outcome of yes, no, and it's generally insincere. It's generally something that leads into and therefore yes, no, right?
Right.
And it's very
right. Yes, the world's complex, but they voted for these leaders, but they educate their children to hate and kill, but they constantly lie to the international community, you know. So it's the examples from your piece,
yeah.
You know, it's that sort of the yes, but is sort of the yes. I get that the world is complex, that these situations are cruel, but you guys are actually raped people, or but you guys are part of a colonial empire, or but you're bombing us to smithereens. And it's like, okay, yes, but it's like, again, there's no way out from that.
And there is actually a third version, a third response that is possibly the most problematic, which would be to say, oh, you know, the world is so complex. What can you do?
What you call odierism.
Odierism,
yeah.
Which is something I took from Adam Curtis. He has a short video that talks about this. This approach that says that, if you like the world is complex. We have to acknowledge that we can't identify good and bad, and whatever we do, there are unintended consequences. So, what can you do? And one of the arguments about raising the point about complexity is like when you're saying complexity, you're trying to shut me up. You're trying to say, oh, there's nothing you can do. No, by saying complexity, I actually mean, we need to learn to work with complexity. We need to acknowledge complexity, and then use complexity to look forward, and to look forward not through linear comparisons, and definitely not through binary comparisons, but through something I see my work as in mapping as being relevant here. Like I think we need to look through more dimensions on problems and acknowledge that it's not a race that would give me a final answer who's the best victim or who's the worst the worst militant. It's a map.
where we will need to rearrange different stakeholders and different effects to be able to draw the map differently so we can continue living here together. And that's why what I advocate in that piece is yes and. Every time we try to say yes but, we should switch that with yes and. We need to acknowledge multiple statements, multiple factors to be able to understand how to calibrate between them, to acknowledge them, and to try to address them simultaneously. And that's really, really hard. But there's no other way. And I think that's something that that we try to do with the Land for All.
What can people far away do that's constructive? You know, right now it feels like I see on at least on campuses and places where I feel like I could have some influence, I see people taking extreme sides and shouting sensationalist language at each other, you know, or labeling the other side one thing or another. I'm wondering what sorts of actions can help. You know, so there's energy. People are willing to spend time and energy to do something. What is that?
Yeah. So it's critical. Like that question is super important, and it's super important for me to make that point. It's not about statements now. We are beyond the point of statements unless they actually have any effect. I wrote another article since then that is focused exactly on that. And the title of the article is Israel Commits Suicide of Biblical Proportions and America is There to Assist. Because I feel like America, in its attempt to so-called stand with Israel, is just being a bystander as Israel is pushing itself and the Palestinians off the cliff. The 5 points that I try to make towards the end of that piece is that America and Americans should push towards 5 points. One is to remove the veto support of this government from the UN Security Council. I think Netanyahu's war is Netanyahu's war at this point. The only person he's actually helping is himself. He hasn't managed the army operation did not manage to save a single hostage. A single hostage. There was one that was miraculously found, and that's another unclear story. But the government, the army has been trying to save hostages and actually either leading to their death or actually killing them.
They killed two of them. Yeah,
they've killed more than two of them.
directly two with waving white flags. I mean, those.
It was it was more. I would say at this point the war does nothing for Israel. So even if you're in a position that of trying to justify that in any way, if you really, really want to be Israel's friend, let alone you don't want to be Israel's friend, but do not give this blind check. So the U.S. has been giving Israel a blind check by lending its veto right in the UN Security Council, and it's been writing the checks to fund this war, which leads me to the second point. The U.S. can and should pull funding from offensive military actions and support only defensive ones. So you don't need to say no military support whatsoever, but you can say military support only for defensive ones. And there are a lot of defensive ones, including Iron Dome. I don't think there's an argument against the Iron Dome there. The third one is to demand the help, demand and help facilitate a truly sustainable ceasefire that would allow an urgent humanitarian aid and opportunity for a hostage deal. And the point there is that on the word sustainable, it's not unlike the last one. And any day when now we might get another ceasefire. I hope this one would learn from the mistakes of the previous one. And then immediately commit to a long, costly, and complicated reconstruction and administration of Gaza by an international alliance that is led by Arab leadership, right? This is not the green zone again. It needs to have the legitimacy of the region and the region's leaders. And then the fifth one is to develop a firm framework of incentives and counter-incentives to support trust building and de-radicalization on both sides of the fence. So and right now this government, the Netanyahu government, and this government, the Hamas government, are not supposed to get rewards for anything that they've done over the past almost 4 months. They have lost their legitimacy. They are not partners to the future of this region. Now, I'm not talking about. I'm not a part of the people who fool themselves that Hamas is something that is going to disappear miraculously. Neither do I expect that the radicals on the Israeli right would disappear immediately. They are a part of the yes and that we will have to deal with. But Hamas is an ideology. You can try to kill the militants. You can try to kill their leaders. You can't kill the idea unless you bring a better idea. And the better idea cannot be the oppression and humiliation of Palestinian people for almost six decades. You can go back forever, basically. Palestinians, and that's what we're trying to do with the Land for All, Palestinians have the right to find out who they are when they're not occupied and oppressed. And I would say beyond that, Israelis have the right to find out who they are when they're not occupying and oppressing. And that's why I'm actually not a supporter of this idea, just, you know, make it a one state. Just make it a one state, give everybody democratic rights. It sounds good, but it's just replacing, creating legal forms top down and telling these two people who have been, whose identities have been forged around this conflict, just miraculously forget about it. That's not going to happen so soon. That would just turn what is now an ethnic conflict into a civil war. You can call it civil war because everybody would be civilians and would be equally slaughtered. We need that opportunity for self-determination. I've never been a big fan of nations. But you don't go from zero to 100 immediately, and that is a part of what we're trying to take into account with the Land for All.
It is interesting. So, Land for All is ultimately, I guess, advocating for a two-state solution.
Yes, that and yes, and the two-state solution has been. That has been the model that it has almost become synonymous with peace. But the two-state solution, the way we've known it since the 90s, was also based on the paradigm of separation, but also based on the idea that we can't get along,
we will never get along. So let's just decide where to put the wall and let's make sure it's a big and heavy wall. So we never see the other side anymore, and they can have their own country over there. Just stop bugging us. That is not a way to build a future in this region. And if anyone had any doubt about that, after October, I think October 7th is the most extreme collapse of the separation paradigm, because the fence around Gaza was the most sophisticated fence with, you know, overground fence and underground fence, and you know, cyber security and you know, intelligence and whatever, all of the technology you want to make sure that they would never be able to break that wall. Lo and behold, and when you build such strong fences, when these fences break, you get the most horrible extreme violence that you can possibly imagine. If anyone believes that you can have separation after October 7th, it's like, it's really insane. The only way to build a solution has to be beyond that paradigm of separation. And with what we're advocating is not the classic two-state solution, but what we call two states, one homeland. It's important to understand that yes, it needs to be two states with a right to self-determination, two parliaments, two different citizenship. Palestinians vote for the Palestinian parliament. Israelis vote for the Israeli parliament. And but it's also one homeland, because Palestinians are, you know, they're not only in Nablus and Hebron and Jenin. They are part of Haifa and Acre and Jaffa and you know, cities that have been a part of Israel since 1948. And one of the things that have been a blocker for any peace agreement is the problem of so-called the refugee problem. Like, what do you do with the people who were kicked out of their homes back in 1948? And now they're, you know, many of them have been in Gaza. Gaza is mostly refugees. Many of them are in Lebanon or in Jordan or in the US or all over. And they want to come back, and they want to come back to their ancestral homes. And from the other side, you know, I'm not a religious Jew, but my family from my grandfather's side have lived in Hebron for 10 generations, and Hebron is one of the biggest Palestinian cities. I'm personally not connected to. I don't have a strong will to, you know, to leave the cities of the Bible again, but I do acknowledge that many of my family members do, and for them this is something that defines very critical elements of who they are. When I'm not afraid when I hear from the river to the sea, right? From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, and yes, so will Israel. We can have two states with open borders that are built on trust that we need to build, and what we're doing now is just making everything so much harder. But we managed to do that in the past. Like, look, nobody believed that Israel and Egypt would ever, you know, live one next to the other the way we do, but Egypt was the biggest existential threat to Israel, but after the peace agreement it stopped being that, and that is the biggest security asset that Israel has ever had. And in the same time, we, you know, 2 million Palestinians
who happen to have an Israeli citizenship live with us. We see them every day. You know, they tend to us in hospitals. We see them. We live next to them. It's far from being ideal, and it's far from being equal, and there are a lot of problems there. But at the same time, we have proved that it's possible. So it's not some suggestion that is out there. We need to have two states with open borders that would allow freedom of movement, freedom of residency, freedom of work, freedom of worship, freedom of study. You can live between the river and the sea and be a citizen of one of the two states. And that's what we're advocating. And about Jerusalem, which is another kind of key issue, Jerusalem can be the capital of both states. There's really not a problem with that. It's all about definitions. We can get this yes and, right?
Right. I mean, but the yes and approach to existence, you know, undermines a lot of things, right? It undermines some notions of property and capitalism and exclusivity and nationalism. You know, it's hard for people, I think, to accept that. I mean, how much of this is social construction? How much of this is the words that we're putting on things? You know, that it's not, that it doesn't have much to do with material reality, these things that we're arguing over.
I don't think it's so far from first of all, I think at this point, a land for all, two states, one homeland, is the most pragmatic option on the table. Like the separation paradigm, either the two-state solution and definitely the one-state solution, either, you know, an apartheid state or an Islamic state or a miraculously, why kumbaya, why can't we just get along state? Neither of them make any sense. And yes, it may seem utopic, and I'm not even arguing that it needs to be exactly the way we imagine it right now. With political imagination, one of the most important things that you need to acknowledge is that it wouldn't happen exactly like you imagined. But we need a sense of direction, and the sense of direction is not about separation. And it's not about fixing one injustice by creating another injustice. We can share this land. We've proven that we can, and now we have to. We have a lot of opposition against us, both from the extremists that just, you know, want eternal war. Unfortunately, also from the international and mainly American left that, you know, it doesn't fit the model of decolonial justice that they're hoping for. I'm sorry about that. We need allies. We need real allies that actually care about people living together, that actually care beyond these paradigms of separation that are propagated by those who take a side as if that is the just way, that is promising anything but war for the future.
And do you find you have allies in the US around the world, or is it feeling mostly local right now?
I think we do. And a land for all has actually, you know, this movement has been, is about, you know, it started 12 years ago. And it started picking a lot of steam in the past two years, I would say. Around September of 2023, we decided to change the model of the organization and to be a truly a joint organization with an equal Palestinian and Israeli board. We have two co-directors, two amazing women, Rula Khardal and Mai Pundak, Palestinian and Israeli, and our first joint board meeting was on October 10th, 3 days after. When the body count was unfathomable, when everybody was still shocked and still in so much pain, and there was so much pain in that meeting, but at the same time so much solidarity, and so much hope, and Eileen, you know, today, I'm not a religious person in any way, but if I would have been, I think Rebecca Solnit would become my priest. I'm really relying on her concept of a hope in the dark, and the way she defines it in a book that is under this title, A Hope in the Dark, is that when she's saying hope in the dark, she doesn't mean that hope exists in a dark and scary and bad place, but that hope can only exist in the place of darkness, in the place of not knowing, in a place where you don't know what the future would be. You have to look into the darkness and find the clues and in a way believe that change is possible, and we believe that change is possible, but it's not this hope is not something, it's not optimism, it's not something you wait for and say, oh no, it would be fine. Hope is something you try to find and then you try to create, and creating and materializing that hope is something that is happening right now, and we're seeing how the response. And we do have allies in the US and and in the EU and around the world, our two co-directors are going to tour the US now for 2 weeks, and there's a lot of hunger for a new vision, and there's a lot of interest and understanding that this moment is a moment of opportunity. So I have to be hopeful, and I really hope that your listeners would understand that there's a certain liability with taking sides, and if you have to take a side, take the side of the living, take the side of the future. Not the side of death, not the side of war, not the side of violence. Yeah. Managed to not start crying until this point, but I'm shaking a bit.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard.
It's really painful. Because I'm afraid. I'm really very afraid. I have two kids. I have a family here. And hope is in the dark. And I know the chances are really slim. I'm not fooling myself. You know, I may try to talk with conviction, but I'm full of doubt and full of fear. And it's hard to walk in the dark for so long. Yeah. But you know, we can't freeze.
Yeah. And I guess the fear is not the existential fear, you know, of one thing happening or another, but fear of continued violence and oppression. And
you know, in the second article that I wrote, I I refer to the story of Samson. Samson was this in the book of Judges. Samson was this very powerful so-called judge, which and the Bible speaks about Samson's feats of violence and you know, arson and theft and all of the horrible things that he did to the Philistines, especially around Gaza, right?
Right.
So he was a hero to the Hebrews by mainly being a violent thug.
Yeah.
And the end of his story is where, you know, the secret of his superpower is revealed, and the Philistines cut his hair, which was the source of his superpower, and they poke his eyes and they chain him to the temple of Dagon, which was the big temple in Gaza, and then he prays to God for the last time. To give him the last power to avenge but one of his two eyes. So he's blinded and he's impotent, right? And he's asking for one bit of strength just to have his revenge. And then he pulls the columns of the temple, and he kills more Philistines than he killed in his life. Hooray, hooray. And this is what we're doing in Gaza. And as he pushed the columns, he cries, let my spirit, let my soul perish with the Philistines. The Israeli soul is perishing with the Philistines, or with the Palestinians now. It's my soul.
Right. It's a self-annihilation in through this violence.
It's a suicide. Yeah. And it's I'm scared to death. And we need help. We need help. And it's more complex. But it's not, oh dear. It's not, and it's not yes, no, and it's not yes, but it is yes, and. And it's possible. And hope exists, even if it's dark. I have to believe in that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what, you know, we've been trying to do with this Team Human project, if there is one, is to help people kind of have the courage to embrace the ambiguity of the human experience in that yes and fashion, you know, that to not combat or even transcend, but to you know, move past the binaries that are really amplified by digitality. You know, the digital age is so yes, no, 1-0, you know, in its structure and in its expression, that it makes it even, well, you would say even harder, but maybe what it does is it makes, you know, yes or no thinking so much more apparent, so much more obvious, that maybe it becomes easier to see the alternatives to it now that it's been sort of laid out for us, you know, so exactly.
We can see that in technology very, very strongly. Like even, you know, one of the strong, the main challenges of machine learning is condensing dimensions, right? Like taking dimensions from data and finding a way to get to a number, or ideally to get to a threshold, and that threshold is that binary. Did it pass the threshold or not pass the threshold? But by getting a lot of data and just condensing it back down to the level of the number, or down to the level of the binary.
Right.
And I'm completely with you that this is this has such a deep cultural effect, and because when
One of the arguments you mentioned that BDS has been going against Standing Together, which I think is, you know, it's such a huge mistake. But and what they're arguing is that Standing Together is a part of the Zionist plot to normalize Zionism.
Right.
So, okay, you don't want to normalize Zionism. What do you want to normalize? We need to be able to say what we don't want, and we need to try to say what we do want. And Standing Together as an organization that has been working about it's one of the strongest shared community organizations in Israel, led by amazing Palestinian and Israeli team. So you don't want to normalize Zionism, but they're not normalizing Zionism. They're normalizing partnership. They're normalizing what we should strive for. If you want to normalize war, then don't support them. I'm actually writing about that actually with a lot of reference, mainly based on design and technology, looking at friction and flow. So you create friction in the flow, but you create friction to oppose the flow and create a new flow instead, right? What is the flow that we're trying to create? We won't be able to control it because it's complex, like water. But if we don't have a vision of the future, if we can't imagine futures and we only imagine the friction, then we stay in a constant moment of friction without the materialization of anything new, except the things that other people imagined for us. And these other people, you know, they can be nationalists, they can be capitalists, they can be, you know, racist. Those who have a vision will be able to shape the new flow, and it has to be us,
right? But there's a deep attraction to opposition, you know. There's a deep attraction, especially if you felt repressed and you've witnessed the repression of others and you have a sense of empathy for them, to want you know, to fight back, to push against, that you don't quite feel real and alive if you're not somehow fighting the power. That, and I worry that especially so many young people who've woken up to systems of oppression, that it's I understand that the deep attraction to, you know, committing oneself to punching up at what you know, at those at the oppressor.
That's where you know, another priest in my emerging religion is Ursula K. Le Guin. And in her article, the carrier bag theory of fiction, she compares between two prehistoric technologies, the spear and the carrier bag, and she said, we have been using the first technologies that we've been used have been carrier bags, but the stories that were left on these caves are stories of spears. Why? Because it's easier to tell that story. It's easier to at the end of the day to come back to the cave and say, oh, you won't believe, you know, how we jumped on that mammoth and we killed it and you know, it hurt us and we ran and then something else happened. And that it's easier to tell that story, especially easier than saying, oh, we collected these nuts and these leaves and everything. And then somebody told the joke and then we continued and everything. The carrier bag, that's complexity. The spear is that linear arc of the hero that stubs the story at the end. And towards this, the end of this article that everybody has to read, she said, I said it's hard to tell that story. I didn't say it's impossible. And we have to tell different stories. We have to tell stories that are about the carrier bag, about complexity, about how things sit within this that bag together and how do they influence each other. And that's also the map that I'm talking about. We need to map these relationships rather than stub them with a spear. That's that linearity, that quantifiability versus that ambiguity.
And it seems that that's the kind of thing that we can really only do as incarnate beings, you know, that the mathematics, I mean, maybe somebody will figure out a math that does this, but the mathematics and the ideas and the abstractions can't get to this, that this is much more something, well, like when you're saying, like compassion is just metabolizing someone's trauma. It's not about judging it as right or wrong or taking action on it. It's happening in this other, you know, in another space of human awareness and human capacity, which is not, it's not even the rational at that point. It's the embodied, it's the on the ground, it's the actual people, which is why, you know, I keep saying we need, certainly as American intellectuals, we need to defer to the human beings on the ground and support them in what they're trying to go through, rather than making judgments or you know, condemning different players, because we're not there.
Yeah, the condemnation game has been really unhelpful. It's not about who's to blame. There's a lot of blame to go around. It is about how are you helping build a better tomorrow? And so, sorry for that, you know, kitschy phrase, but we have to build a better tomorrow, right? We can't go back to October 6th. It's not going to be you know, Israel and Palestine, however you know, that's not going to be your post-colonial, decolonial fantasy. And, you know, it's going to be a new thing. And it's going to be so. And you know, we're not inventing something out of thin air. You can look at the end of World War II. If you would tell someone in France just a few decades the city would be full of German hipsters and vice versa, they'll be looking at you as if, what are you talking about?
Yeah, well, by the same token, though, if you tell Americans that without a different approach, our southern border is going to look more like Gaza than like Texas, you know, that there are hundreds of millions of climate refugees on the way to, whether it's to Europe or to Turkey or to Central America, that this is not some irreconcilable old religious problem of the Middle East, that this is all of our problem. You know, this is these are global questions and local questions for everybody, not just something over there.
The environment doesn't care about these lines that we drew on the map. We talk about different countries' commitment to climate change because stopping climate change or to lowering the carbon footprint, as if the world works that way. We have limited ourselves into these frameworks of separation, and we can't get rid of them overnight. We need to work with them, but when you're trying to create to advance any peace agreement in Israel and Palestine, the problem of water comes, and then there's underground water. How do you calculate exactly where to draw the line on underground water, right? And when you zoom out a bit, you see that this region, like many other regions, are becoming more and more dry, and we need to work together. Because people are not going to respect these lines that you draw on the map, as they don't have food and they don't have water, and they can't go outside because they can't breathe. We have to transition into something that is completely different, and when you're arguing from the river to the sea, you know the river is drying up and the sea level is going up. We need to really change our frameworks. We need to really work on partnership, because it's not that modernist nation-based world that is going to survive. It's a world that is based on partnership, and that should be the focus.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thanks, Mushan. Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Always a pleasure.
I know everyone, you know, it's like everyone there is going through enough, and then they're also being asked to perform for Western media. But hopefully it helps position people listening to us, at least, to maybe direct their efforts and attention towards more productive ends. And gosh, I mean, you're not supposed to say it, but my hopes and prayers are with you.
Thanks, Doug. It's we've known each other now for almost 20 years, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And thank you for being on Team Human. Our guest today was Mushan Zer-Aviv. You can find links to his articles in the show notes or by going to mushan.com. You may also want to check out alandforall.org. Any question you might want to ask me about the Middle East crisis is better answered there. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.